So, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for coming. When I was in Iran recently, I was over and over conscious that I wasn't going just for myself. I'm going also as a representative, not only of at least some Americans, but also of all those who have supported our work over the years, and that includes many of you here this evening. And I want to thank you very much for the support you've given us over the years, some of you very, very generously, and thank you very much for coming this evening. The talk here is being recorded this evening because quite a lot of people have expressed interest in this presentation, which I think is one of the most topical probably ever at an IHR meeting. Just this past week, the President of Iran and the Prime Minister of Israel both spoke at the United Nations and gave talks that were very closely followed by many people around the world. And of course, for many, many months, the Prime Minister of Israel has repeatedly threatened to attack Iran if it develops what he calls a capability for a nuclear weapon. And so this has been very much in the news over a long period of time. Some of you may remember that when George Bush was president, he referred to Iran as, he called it, the axis of evil. And some also may remember that when John McCain was running for president 4 years ago, he even joked about bomb, bomb, bomb Iran. People talk very often in America very loosely about war. Few countries have attacked as many countries, have gone to war as many times over the years, as has the United States of America. I was talking earlier this evening about how war is something very different for Europeans or for people in the Middle East than it is for many Americans. This is something that made an enormous impression on me when I was first in Europe. People in Europe realize war is a terrible thing. It means their fathers and sons or husbands are killed. It means refugees. It means destroying of cities, destruction, terrible suffering, terrible misery, and terrible death. In this country, fortunately, America is a country in which war has been something that takes place far away. So when John McCain jokes about war, or when people talk very loosely, sometimes you hear them, why don't they just turn that country into a parking lot? They don't realize the gravity of what they're saying and the gravity of the policies they carry out and just how terrible the consequences are for not only those countries, but really for the whole world. As I said, that this is a very, very topical thing because Iran has been in the news so much, and it's one of the reasons I very much wanted to go to Iran. I wanted to go to understand better something about a country that is being threatened and which our leaders have denounced in such strong and vehement terms over the years. Not long ago, a public opinion poll by CNN Gallup showed that 71% of Americans think that Iran has nuclear weapons. Now, this is fantastically a falsehood. In fact, the defense minister, defense minister of Israel, Ehud Barak, even said a few months ago that Iran has not even, in his words, made even a decision if it even wants to make nuclear weapons. But a poll showing that a solid majority of Americans thinking something this outrageously wrong doesn't merely show ignorance, it shows the extent to which the American public over the years has been systematically misinformed, misled, misguided about Iran and, I would argue, about many other issues as well. And the ignorance about Iran, about the conditions in the country, about what the country is all about, and about the Middle East generally, is so widespread that all the more important is it that there be greater understanding among the American people about conditions in the Middle East and in Iran, and conditions and understanding in other countries about the real conditions here in this country. Now, in this talk, I'm going to try to do three things, and it's not going to be easy to combine it, and there'll be some overlapping. I'm going to talk a little bit about my own experiences in Iran, what happened while I was there. I'm going to talk a little bit about what I saw about Iranian people, about Iranian culture, about the politics, about something about the country. And then I'm going to try to sum up by talking about what I think this means for America in the world. What we as Americans should get out of all of this, and what the larger lessons of us all are for all of us. Now, during the 9 days or 10 days that I was in Iran, It was far busier, far more productive than I had really expected. I didn't talk very much with people about this trip before I went. There were several reasons for that, but one of them was that I was supposed to go actually in February, and that fell through for some various reasons, and I was supposed to go in May, and I didn't finally go until the very end of August, the beginning of September. Now, one of the reasons that I was invited to Iran is because over the years, I've had many, many ties, contacts, relations with Iran. Over the last several years, I've done dozens, maybe hundreds, but certainly many dozens of interviews with Iranian radio, with the English language service of the Iranian external broadcasting. And I've done also interviews on Iranian television. I've done interviews with country media in many other countries as well, but I've done quite a lot of media interviews with Iran. And usually they call up when they want some comment about something going on in the media about conditions here in the United States. I don't presume to talk about Iran. I'll talk sometimes about international affairs, but usually the interviews have to do with something going on here in this country. But so I had gotten to know by telephone at least, or by Skype, a number of people in Iran over time, and that's one of the reasons I was invited. So there are people who were familiar with what I'm doing with the IHR and so forth. Now, during this time, I thought if I do nothing more in this trip than simply learn more about conditions there and meet with a few people that I had been in touch with over the years, I would be very happy. But as it happened, I did much more than that. It was a very, very hectic time. There was hardly a time that I wasn't doing something or meeting with people or active in some sort of way. So it was a very busy time and also a very productive time. I did much, much more than I had expected. Some highlights of this 9-day time there included an appearance on a very important primetime public affairs television show hosted by a very, very capable man, which I appeared on this primetime show. That was one highlight. Another highlight was a meeting with the president of the country, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, of course, has been very vilified here in the United States, and I'll say a little bit more about that. But then, for me, the most gratifying time at all during the time I was there was a talk I gave to an assembly of 800 students, mostly from the University of Tehran, at a large meeting hall in the center of the city. And that was a very, very gratifying high point of it all. But it also included many interviews. I did quite a few interviews with media in Iran. But also I met with many Iranian journalists, writers, thinkers, officials, and even ordinary people, of course. And in addition to that, met with people from many other countries, including a number of Americans. One person I got to know fairly well because he was also invited in more or less the same context was Merlin Miller, who is running for president as the candidate of the American Third Position Party. And anyway, he and I were in the same hotel, and so every morning we'd all have breakfast in the same place along with quite a few other people, and I got to know him fairly well. And again, one of my main goals during this time was to learn more about people, conditions, politics, and so forth, culture of Iran, about the situation, about the great question, well, would there be an attack? What would be the response of the people there? And also, I wanted to explain and to help people in Iran to get a better understanding of real conditions here in this country. When I landed in Tehran, I was pretty struck by something about how I was going to be treated during the time. I was met at the airport by an official. I was taken to what they call a CIP lounge. That doesn't mean the very important person. It means the commercially important person lounge. And I was on the same flight as a Tunisian filmmaker, and we got to know each other fairly well because we both had problems with our luggage and getting organized coming in and so forth. You may not know it, but Iranians who visit the United States are required now by the U.S. government to be fingerprinted. And so, in the name of reciprocity, Americans who land in Iran are also fingerprinted, which is how governments do these kind of things. When government does something, then the other government will do the same kind of thing. So that was when we were treated right up from the very beginning in this special way. Well, actually, we landed at about 1 in the morning. So when the next morning, I hadn't gotten much sleep, and of course it was a 12-hour flight from Los Angeles to Istanbul, and then a 3-hour flight from Istanbul to Tehran, so I wasn't entirely tip-top shape. But the next morning I got up, and I wanted to, because the conference itself didn't start until the next day, I wanted to, as I often try to do in any new place, is just go to some place in the city to see people, see what conditions are like, meet people, try to understand something just of ordinary life. And I took a taxi, and I went to a large plaza or square in the north of Tehran. Now, Tehran is a very large and bustling city. I heard different estimates of the population of it. Some say 10 million, some say 12 million, some said 16 million, but it's a very, very large city. It's divided basically into three sections, the north, the center, and the south. The north is the rich part of the city. It's richer because it's a little higher up. The air is not as polluted in the rest of the city. The further south you go, the poorer the city is. The real bustling center is the center of the city where the main roads and shops and so forth, but there's much more wealth per capita in the north of Tehran than there is in other parts of the city. Anyway, I took a taxi off to a square, and I just spent an afternoon just sort of looking at things. I went to a bookstore. I went to an internet cafe. And I went into a shop. I had a lot of art items for sale, paintings and antiques and so forth. And I walked in, and maybe my clothes or whatever, but it was obvious that I was not a typical Iranian. And when I was walking around, a woman said to me, she said in English, if there's anything you'd like to know more about, please tell me. She said in very good English. Well, this woman actually was a U.S. citizen. She's an Iranian, U.S. Citizen. She lives in Iran, had lived for years in the United States in just north of Washington, D.C. And so she said, well, would you like to have some tea? And so we talked for about an hour, hour and a half or so forth. And she was one of just many sort of ordinary people I got to meet and talk about in this way. This woman is a well-to-do person. And like many people who are well-to-do, they're less happy or more unhappy with the regime, with the government, than are many of the poorer people. The richer people tend to be far more secular. They tend to be much more contemptuous of the regime and the religious aspects of it and so forth. And she vented for quite a while about her take on things too. Now, I'm going to talk a little bit more about people in Iran and their attitudes toward the government and so forth, but that was just the first day. It was also interesting going to a bookstore. There's a lot of bookstores in Iran. Iranians are a people who have a tremendous love of and appreciation for literature and especially poetry. It's a very, very big thing in Iran, and I'll tell a little bit more about that. But that was on the first day, and then I tried to catch up on some much-neglected sleep. Well, what I was invited for was something called International Independent Filmmakers Festival and Conference. This was put on by the Ministry of Culture. It was organized by somebody who works in their foreign ministry, a man who is a former ambassador to several countries. And I was invited, not that I'm a filmmaker, but I was invited because for the conference part of this thing. The actual conference began the next day, and I was invited to participate in this conference. It wasn't until that morning, and maybe this is, I don't know, typical or untypical, very often I didn't know actually what was going to happen. None of us knew what was going to happen until just before it happened. I didn't know how long I was going to speak. I didn't know if I was going to speak. I didn't know what the whole schedule of the thing was. And there was a kind of seat-of-the-pants aspect to the whole conference as it took place. What happened at the beginning was, I learned, fairly typical. The conference opened with some officials giving a talk and so forth, but it always began. Every meeting I went to in Iran began the same way. It always begins with a recitation from the Quran, and people stand and they play the national anthem. This is a very big thing in Iran. I mean, it's an Islamic republic, and they're Iranians, and they're very proud of being Iranians. And this emphasis on national identity and on religious identity is an extremely important one, one that I'm going to talk about a little bit more, and one that has to be understood to appreciate the outlook, the mindset, not only of people in Iran, but in many other countries as well. Well, the first morning there was the opening ceremony. Some people gave some sort of highlighted presentations and talks. There were several officials who spoke, including the organizer, the main person who organized the conference. And then in the afternoon, according to the schedule, there were several smaller sections of which I was supposed to give a talk as well. Well, one of the things that has appeared a lot in the Iranian media over the past year or so is the Occupy Wall Street movement in the United States. I was first conscious of just how important a role this plays in Iran when it began in March of 2011, basically when the Occupy Wall Street movement first started hitting the headlines. And I got a call from the Iranian radio, and they said, well, Mr. Weber, what's your take on this Occupy Wall Street movement? Now, it's important to understand, in Iran, the media presents the Occupy Wall Street movement as something analogous, something similar to the popular movements that overthrew Mubarak in Egypt, that overthrew the government in Tunisia, and more or less gives the impression that the American public is sort of ready to storm the White House and overthrow the government. Well, I said at the time in the interview, I said that the Occupy Wall Street movement represents a level of dissatisfaction about the system, about things going on in America, but I predicted that it would go up and then it would disappear after a time, which is in fact what happened. But that hasn't stopped the media in Iran from really emphasizing this. In fact, when I was there, there was a documentary, so-called, on the Occupy Wall Street movement on Iranian television, on their English language station, giving this impression, you see, that the masses of people are out to storm the barricades or so forth. Well, this came up repeatedly throughout the time I was there, and I was asked about this during interviews. Well, this came up really strongly during that first day. There was a session being hosted on the Occupy Wall Street movement. And I thought, well, I'm not going to really say anything. I'll just sit and listen to all of this. And so I listened as one person from Tunisia or maybe from Italy starts talking about the Occupy Wall Street movement, something they really don't know anything about. And finally, after listening to this, I put up my hand and I said that one of the greatest failings of human beings, I think, is the tendency to wishful thinking, to imagine how things are based upon what way we want them to be. And I said, the Occupy Wall Street movement is not at all as some of these people are presenting it. I said, the Occupy Wall Street movement is made up of people who have no clear goals, they have no clear idea of really what they want to accomplish, except basically they want things, we're the 99%, we want justice. They have no leadership, they had no real program. And I made the more strong point that most of these people actually voted for Barack Obama. But instead of directing their anger at Barack Obama and the Democratic Party or the Congress for allowing Wall Street to do what it does, it's directing its anger at Wall Street, which is doing just what comes naturally. It's trying to make money. Wall Street gets bailed out by Congress. It's not the fault of Wall Street that they're just making as much money as they can, getting away with as much as they can by the rules. Their anger should be directed at the political leadership, but it's not. And anybody who had, I mean, I went by the so-called Occupy Wall Street movement here in Irvine, a pathetic kind of thing. But these people talk about occupying Wall Street. All they did was occupy parks, really. And the media, I mean, in fact, the politicians in America, most cities were amazingly indulgent. They allowed these people to occupy parks long past the time that anybody should have normally permitted such a thing. And then finally, when the police came in and they resisted, that was the scenes that were on television showing these brutal policemen going against the people. Well, this is very, very misleading. And I said the Occupy Wall Street movement is something like a leftist version of the Tea Party movement. It's a lot of unhappy people. There's a lot of unhappiness in America. But the American public is very, very confused, as we've talked about many times, about how this has all happened and why it's happening. Americans are very, very frustrated, but they don't know quite who to blame, so they mouth these slogans like Stand Up for America, as the Tea Party people say, or we're the 99%. Well, those are just slogans, and they have no really clear program. Well, the host of the thing was a man who has lived for many years in the United States, and much to my surprise, but also I was gratified, he agreed. He says, well, that's very good, he said. Because the presentation in the media in Iran about America in this regard is inaccurate, but not as dangerously so as much of the depiction of events and conditions in Iran is here in this country. But that was the first day, and several people were struck, I think, by the remarks I made in that regard. And then I also gave, I was slotted to give a talk of about 20 minutes, and I thought a lot, of course, on before I went to Iran, and also when I saw the sort of layout of the whole format, what I was going to say. So I gave a very, I think, concentrated talk of about 20 minutes. I talked about who I am, what the IHR is doing, why it's important that I think events like this take place. I talked a little bit about the United States, and I made some basic points that I've made over and over and over again. That is, the great danger of war in the world, the great danger of a war against Iraq, against Iran, the turmoil and the strife in the Middle East is above all engineered by those people who are very strong supporters of Israel, because their primary interest is not the interest of humanity, not the interest of America, but the interest of Israel. And our political system, our cultural system, is very, very much centered and oriented according not what's best for the American people, but what's best for Israel. Now, I give many examples of this, but that's why the misguidance, the misinformation, the misleading of the American people is of a piece with the same danger that is threatening now Iran and has already led to the attack and the ill-fated, of course, invasion and bombing and occupation of Iraq. And this is very, very dangerous in the world. Americans don't understand that. They do not understand the impact that these actions, these horrible actions have around the world and what the consequences were. And I tried to emphasize that in that way, the interests of the 99% of people in the world are the same. The world has an interest in trying to make sure there's not a war with Iran, that there wasn't a war with Iraq, and these wars benefit only a very, very small number of people. Anyway, I made these kinds of points. I made some points about the United States, and I made it, I think, pretty cogently. Afterwards, after I gave this talk, the head of the organizer of the event, a man named Golam Reza Montazemi, came up to me and he said he was very impressed and he asked me if I would like to meet the president. Well, I was very struck by that and pretty amazed because that wasn't on the schedule, as far as I knew, when I went there. But as it happened during the course of the time I was there, I got to know really better people, I mean, people better, and I got to understand really who's who and what's what and so forth. And that was a big, and that continued to be the case as time went on. Then on Wednesday was a very, very fascinating day, the September 5th. There was a large conference. Everybody met at this conference, and we're discussing a final communique, a kind of statement about this meeting that was taking place and what everybody sort of agreed on. And the original text of this final statement was rather wordy and so forth, and there was some discussion about how it should be written. And there was a reference in the communique to Hollywood being Zionist-dominated. Now, that's a point that was made by a number of people throughout the course of this conference. And in fact, that point's been made even by the president of Iran on several occasions. And so, but there was one person at the conference who was Jewish, who was from Los Angeles, and he objected to this. He didn't like the fact that there was a reference to Zionist-dominated Hollywood. And another person thought, well, he was from Italy, he thought this wouldn't be very adroit and a very good thing. It might be true, but it's best not to put that in, and some other people objected. And so the conference organizer, this became a very big issue of controversy, they decided to continue the discussion until Friday morning. And so it was put off until Friday morning, continued at that time. But it set the tone for the one kind of issue of contention that existed at this conference. And I'll get back to that. Later that day, or that evening, was the meeting with the president. Everybody was called together, the people who were participants at this conference and the film festival, to go to the presidential center. I don't call it a palace. It's really like a building. It's not any kind of thing like the White House or the presidential palace as one would see it. It's really just a building, and it has a lot of security, of course, as you can well understand. And we went into this large meeting hall. And it was only a few minutes before the meeting actually took place that I was told that I was going to be one of four individuals who was going to address the meeting as well as be there. And so I said, well, that would be fine. And they told us, though, that make it no more than 7 minutes, no more than 7 minutes. Well, one fellow who was a Frenchman, he decided to use every minute of his 7 minutes, and he gave a fairly long speech in French. Another person gave a speech in Arabic, and then two Americans, Merlin Miller and myself, were asked to speak. And my remarks were very, very abbreviated. I just basically expressed appreciation for the honor. I said that I was very impressed by the hospitality of people in Iran, but I said that I am here because I'm very concerned about a power that is threatening your country, that is oppressing people in Palestine, and which is has a very great role in the United States and is responsible for a tremendous amount of the ignorance and the danger here in our country. And it was very general like that. But anyway, that's all I said. But the Ahmadinejad seemed to like what I had to say about that. And then they took pictures and so forth. Everybody shook hands with the president and so forth. But then something remarkable happened after that. One of the men, this man, Nader Talabzadeh, who was a host at the conference, also runs this television show. It's a show something like Charlie Rose, or it's not 60 Minutes. He doesn't take a camera out and catch people, but they have important people or interesting people talk and so forth. And he had myself and Mr. Montezemi, the director of the conference and the festival, appear on this show. And the previous day, or 2 days before, I had given to Mr. Talabzadeh a flyer from the IHR. And in the meantime, he had looked up the IHR website, and he said he was very impressed. And so when I was on the show at this big television center, he ran a film clip of the website of the IHR. And he's very impressed by something that I try to emphasize. The IHR website and what the IHR tries to do, unlike many other organizations in America, is a much more global and a much more historical perspective on things than many other organizations and websites. Now, there are many other groups in America that do similar things, or somewhat similar things. There are political groups, there are educational groups. The IHR is not political. It's educational. Its purpose is not to try to change laws or so forth, except change in a more fundamental way, to change people's understanding, to change their awareness, their realization of what's going on in the world. And we try to emphasize, therefore, put things in a world perspective, a global perspective, and a historical perspective. I believe strongly that the greatest guide to understanding the times we live in and what's happening and the future is a thorough understanding, as much as possible, of the past. Because human beings are human beings. History is really the story of human beings as social beings. And human nature does not essentially change. The idea that one country or another country is, as our politicians like to say, an exception to all of that is childish and arrogant and dangerous. And an understanding of history, an understanding of the world, should make us all not only more aware, but also more humble, more aware of ourselves and our own society and our own culture in this larger tapestry of history and of the world we live in. So that was the appearance on that. And also, during this time, I got to spend a good bit of time talking with this very remarkable man who hosts this show. He lived for 20 years in the United States. He was a pretty secular, non-political person. He made a motion picture, actually, in Iran about the life of Jesus. Many Americans do not realize the way in which Jesus is regarded by Muslims. Jesus is regarded as a prophet. He's revered. He's looked upon with great reverence by Muslims, and he's talked about in the Quran. The contrast between that, and many Americans don't know this, is that for Orthodox Jews, Jesus is an apostate. He's a terrible man. a man who is suffering very horrible tortures in hell for what he did. The attitude towards Jesus is a very different one in the Muslim world than it is among Orthodox Jews in that regard. But anyway, this man made a motion picture about the life of Jesus. He hosts this show. He's a very intelligent man. He went to Columbia University, lived for years in Northern Virginia, and it was very interesting talking with him. He made a lot of points that I had not realized. Just one of many people I talked to during this period that helped me understand much more some of these things about all of this. Now, then the next day, I spent with, especially with a journalist from India. He writes for the Times of India. I spoke a lot, tried to understand much more about India, Pakistan, relations between India and the United States, conditions in India, society, culture, and so forth in that country, because India is the second most populous country in the world. It graduates every year many more engineers now than even the United States does, and it's going to play an increasingly important role in the world we live in and in the future. And with us was a very interesting woman who was a translator, not because she spoke English, but she also spoke not only Farsi and English, but also Hindi, which was really redundant because the Indian journalist actually spoke English very, very well. But I met then with a man who, well, I was told the day before, I was asked, would you be willing to speak to some students? And I said, well, that would be fine. I didn't realize until actually I got to the meeting hall just what kind of meeting this was going to be. I met with the person who organized this event and had a chance, about an hour, to question him, to understand what his own understanding was about America, about all these kinds of issues and so forth. He actually heads an institute of Iranian U.S. or U.S. studies in Iran. And he lectures at the University of Tehran, which is by far the most prestigious university in the country. And anyway, we went to this meeting hall in the center of the city. It's called Friendship Hall, or Friendship Salon. It's called Friendship Salon because it's in a neighborhood in which there is a church, a mosque, and a synagogue. Now, I'm going to talk a little bit more about the Jewish population of Iran. But that's why they emphasize this. The identity in Iran is very much more, or at least as much religious as it is ethnic or racial. Race plays very little role. The consciousness is not really a racial one. It's far more a religious one. Religion is very, very important, as I'm going to reemphasize as in the course of this talk. Well, during this, I went into this building, and I was astonished to see not just, I suspected, maybe 20 students. There were 800 students in this enormous hall. Now, this was very impressive, not just because there were 800 students, but this is during a time when the university was not in session. These are students overwhelmingly from the University of Tehran. The university was on break during this period of time. But 800 people showed up to hear me speak, and the topic that I was speaking on was the Zionist lobby in America. Well, I was prepared to speak about it. I've spoken about it many times in the past, of course, and I made points that for many of us may be obvious, but I think need to be stressed over and over and over again to understand something about the realities of life here in the United States. Well, the students were very impressive in many ways. First of all, that there were 800 of them willing to come in a meeting hall that was very, very hot. It was a very hot day. The meeting hall was not air-conditioned. In fact, I was not able to go back to the hotel, and I didn't wear a jacket as I usually did when I was there. I only had a short-sleeved shirt. And I said at the very end of the talk, when I was thanking everybody for this opportunity, I made the point that when I first came, I was sorry that I hadn't gotten back for a jacket, but after being in this very hot hall, people were fanning themselves. It was very, 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 very hot there. I said, I'm glad, but I'm especially appreciative of those people here in this hall who are much more heavily clothed than I am. And I'm referring to that especially to women. Many of the women were wearing very, they're covered and so forth, very hot. So it was all the more impressive. And I was also impressed by the questions that were asked. It was a question and answer period. Many of the questions are very, very good. Very good questions about Christians in America. Why do so many Christians in America support Zionism and support Israel, unlike Christians in practically every other country of the world? There were some other questions. But in my talk, which went on for a little over 2 hours, I made the point over and over and over that the campaign against Iran and the American media is very, very strongly reflects the agenda, the outlook, and the values of those people who control the media in America. And I emphasize very strongly, of course, the very, very strong control that the media in America has by the organized Jewish community and how much it represents that. Anyone who has lived for very long in any foreign country easily and quickly sees that the presentation of events in the Middle East is very different almost everywhere in the world compared to the way it is in the American media. The American public is given an amazingly distorted view of the reality of the Middle East, of the Palestine-Israel conflict, and of course right now about the Iran situation. And this is reflected, this skewed, bizarre view that Americans are fed and accept, reflected in public opinion polls showing Americans believe a blatant falsehood, is also shown, for example, in the willingness of the American public to believe the lies by the administration that Iraq was a great threat to world peace and had a huge arsenal of dangerous weapons, and that the America could not even wait another few weeks before attacking, bombing, and occupying the country. The American public is being, as I said, systematically misled in this way. And I also emphasize a talk about misconceptions in the United States about Iran, about life in Iran, and so forth. And again, reflecting the agenda, the mindset of those who control the media here in this country. The next day, Friday the 7th, was the conclusion of the festival. And we went to this very large hall. It's been used for symphonies and for ballets and so forth. It was built during the Shah's period, which was the concluding ceremony of all of this. And there were a lot of dignitaries, important people at this event. And there was a large sort of chatting and meeting and socializing before the event. This doesn't happen very often in my life, but two or three times young people came up to me during this time and asked for my autograph. Now, that doesn't happen in Orange County or Washington, D.C. very often, but I'm much more highly regarded in Tehran than I am in the American capital. Well, that's basically sort of concludes the what I actually did when I was in Iran. I want to talk now a little bit about Iranian society and culture and about the people of Iran. Iran, I've been to quite a few countries during my lifetime, and this is the third or fourth Muslim country I've been to. Now, anyone who's lived in a Muslim country cannot help but be very struck by this, that Islam is important, and I can't stress this enough. It means something. Religion is important to these people in a way that Christianity is no longer important to Americans or to Western man. When I was a boy, stores were all closed on Sundays, or certainly Sunday afternoons in the United States. That was one of the last sort of nods or concessions that American society made to Christianity, because Sunday is supposed to be a day of rest. Now, of course, stores are all filled with people on Sunday, and that's been done away with in the United States. But in Iran or in Morocco or in Egypt, Islam is important. People take this seriously. They take religion as seriously as Christians used to take Christianity. It means something in their lives. For centuries, Europeans took Christianity very, very seriously. The most important building in every city was a cathedral. The most important officials were either religious officials or they were people who were sanctified or affirmed by religious authority. This is something that has now disappeared from Western life. Now, whether you think it's good or bad, the point I want to make, though, is how important religion plays a role. And it's important to understand that, because people who don't have that mentality, don't have that, they can either decide that people like that are crazy, or they can decide, well, that's how they look at it, and we should try to understand it, or at least deal with it. But that's a very important point. Now, Iranians, as every Iranian, if you've talked to Iranians very long, will tell you over and over, we're not Arabs. They resent very much the idea that towel heads or Middle Easterners are all the same. This is very, very, I mean, it's typical of the kind of slipshod way in which, in the childish way that the media in America talks about people in this way. Foreigners are foreigners, and of course there's immense distinctions even within the Arab world, much less within the Muslim world. Very few Americans know, for example, the most populous Muslim country in the world isn't even in the Middle East, it's Indonesia. Very few people realize even the most very basic facts about these kinds of distinctions, which are very important to Iranians. Now, Iranians are Indo-European by language. In fact, the name Iran comes from, it's a cognate of the word Aryan. They make a big point that their language is related to European languages, not to the Semitic languages of the Arab world or Hebrew. Having said that, the Arab influence has been a tremendous one in Iranian history. Iranian is written, or Farsi is written, with Arab characters, for example. Many of the words in the Farsi language are of Arab origin. So there's a very, very strong influence in that way. But there's another point, too, that even though Iranians are Muslim, they're a different kind of Muslim. They're Shia Muslims. They're not Sunni. The vast majority of Muslims around the world are Sunni. Now, it's an imperfect analogy, but it's something like the difference between Catholics and Protestants. Again, it's simplistic to put it that way, but it's important to realize that the Shia Islam outlook of Iranians is almost a kind of national religion. It's the only country in the world that has a very strongly, specifically Shia Muslim outlook is Iran. And that's an important part of how they look at things. And you'll find this manifest in many, many different ways, including in speeches recently by the president, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, which I'll get to in just a moment. Now, in addition to that, and this is something that you cannot help but be struck by, Iranians are very, very hospitable people. They're extraordinarily friendly people. Rick Steves is perhaps the best-known or one of the best-known travel guides in the United States. He made a visit not long ago to Iran, and he said of all the countries he visited, the country where people are the most friendly is Iran. And I was, of course, I'm not alone. Everybody is struck by the sense of hospitality, the sense of friendliness, the sense of just curiosity that Iranians have. Educated Iranians overwhelmingly speak at least some English. Most Iranians do not, but educated Iranians do. There's been a lot of ties and contact over the years between Iran and the United States. And Iranians are overwhelmingly very, very friendly toward Americans. In fact, sometimes too friendly. I'll give an example. I mean, if anything, it's a little bit something. Well, insofar as many people do not like the religious strictures of the government, they almost idealize the United States in that regard. We were, one evening, we had dinner at something called the Milad Tower. There's an enormous tower that overlooks the city of Tehran. It's the sixth tallest tower in the world. It's something like the Space Needle or the CN Tower in Toronto, but bigger. It's very, very high. And it's quite an impressive thing. And at the top, there's a very big restaurant. You get a big, huge view of not only of Tehran, but of the mountains to the north. And it's very impressive. Anyway, we were having dinner there, and there was a number of us talking about Iran, the United States, and the world and different countries. And at one point, this young Iranian made the comment, which was surprising. He talked about how Americans are unusually very slender and thin people, he said. I said, slender and thin? I said, Americans are the most overweight people in the world. And I said, well, why do you think they're slender and thin? He said, well, in American movies, they're all slender and thin. Now, I didn't say this to him, but Americans tend to look more like Roseanne Barr than Julianne Moore. But anyway, that's the reality. Now, my point is that very often people's impressions of other countries and other situations is formed by the media in this way. And it's as much important that people in Iran or other countries understand something more about America than Americans, of course, understand situations in other countries. Another thing about Iran, Iranians are a proud people. They are not anybody's fool. They may disagree with the government. They may not like a lot of things, but they are patriotic, and they will fight if there's a war. And this brings up, some other things I want to mention, but Iranians have a very proud heritage, a very proud history. One of the things that struck me at the closing ceremony of this film festival was that the man who recited the Quran had he was chosen obviously because he has a very, very impressive voice. He's a young fellow, spoke very, very well. But he didn't just recite the Quran. No, he also, for about 30 minutes, recited the poetry of Hafiz. He's a 15th century Persian-Iranian poet whose poetry is very revered in Iran. And when I met with the president of the country, I was given as a gift a very sumptuous copy, which I forgot to bring out, of the Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam. Omar Khayyam was a Persian-Iranian astronomer, mathematician, and also a poet. And he's most well known for the English translation by the English writer Edward Fitzgerald, who translated the Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam into English. And it's already, I mean, even the translation is quite a work of literature. But poetry is very important in the Iranian culture, Iranian people. They read a lot of poetry. Bookstores have a lot of poetry. This is important. Now, one of the questions that many people ask and are very curious about is the role of women in Iranian society. As I think I already mentioned, women are obliged to cover their heads in Iran when they're in public. In private, people do whatever they want. But in public, women are supposed to have their heads covered. Alcohol is not allowed legally in Iran, although the drug laws are fairly loose. They're actually more liberal than they are in the United States in many ways. But there's a ban on alcohol because it's forbidden in the Quran. So, and women are covered. But I talked to many, many people, of course, about all of this, and I heard different estimates that if this was not required, maybe only 40-30% of the population of Tehran would still cover their heads. Most women would not in Tehran. But that's not true in the countryside. In the countryside or in smaller towns, people are more traditional in that way. And the covering the head is not just merely a religious thing, it's also part of the culture. And as Rick Steves said in one of his things, Iranians are willing to accept a lot of these things because they don't want their daughters to grow up like Britney Spears or Madonna. They want a conservative society. They believe that there are certain rules that should apply. Now, it's irksome and a bother at times. It means that couples can't hold hands unless they're married in public. They're supposed to be, and it has many odd manifestations. For example, they have stores that sell Givenchy or Victoria's Secret, but it's rather subdued. The advertising only shows a woman's face from here to about here. So you don't see. So you can imagine the head is covered, I suppose. Now, having said that, I was very impressed with the women in Iran. I met many women who are extraordinarily well educated, very smart, and very capable. Many of the 60% of the university students in Iran are women. Many of the most brightest people I met were women, and many who speak very flawless English, even though they've never been in the United States or in Britain. I met one woman who got a master's degree writing on the plays of Tennessee Williams compared to a French philosopher. I only know Tennessee Williams plays for the movies, actually. But anyway, she was very, very well educated, very smart. And the women also, even though they have these restrictions, are quite feminine. There's a lot of makeup, a lot of sort of flirtatiousness among many of the women. Not all of them, but many of them. Iran, I've been told over and over, and I've read this, maybe it's not true, but I've heard over and over, the highest percentage of cosmetic surgery in the world is in Iran. Many, many women have had cosmetic surgery. In fact, people say that many women actually have a bandage over their nose to give the impression that they had cosmetic surgery even if they didn't, because it's considered kind of a prestige thing to have been able to afford it and to have done it. But many of the women also push the limits on what's forbidden and what's allowed right to the limit. They wear a scarf only to here. Their hair is very well done. They'll have high heel shoes. They'll have neck earrings. They'll have cosmetics. Supposedly Iran, I also was told, has the highest per capita consumption of cosmetics in the world. Now, I don't know if that's true, but certainly women are quite aware of that. And I felt very much that the women of Iran struck me as both feminine and strong. And that was a surprising and interesting thing. Now, the media of Iran is dull by American standards. It's not glitzy. It's not bad. It's just in many ways not very exciting. It's more like the Trinity Broadcasting or the Christian Broadcasting Network than it is Fox News or CNN. They have one station, for example, one television channel devoted entirely to religious broadcasting. And I don't mean Christian bridge. It's all about recitations of the Quran, discussions of religious activity and so forth. Then there's, of course, there's two news channels, one in English, one in Farsi, and there's other movies and so forth. But the movies are rather subdued. They're not racy. They're not highly sexual. And it's very interesting being in a society, especially after a while, in which it's not saturated with sex. I mean, we're so used to it now that in billboards, on television, it saturates American culture now to a very, very heavy degree. You do not see that in Iran. It's not it's not permitted. It's forbidden. So that's another bit difference. Now, there are billboards advertising products, selling consumer items and so forth, and there's advertising for this and that. But most of the billboards, or at least a lot of the billboards, are political. Very often there are billboards honoring martyrs who died in the eight-year war of 1980-1988. There are many, many pictures up of Ayatollah Khomeini, who died back in the 80s, but also, or 90, maybe 91, and also of the current, what they call the supreme leader, a man named Khamenei. Now, Khamenei is really the big power. Americans have heard a lot about Ahmadinejad, but Ahmadinejad does not have anything like the power that the man who's called the supreme leader has. Ahmadinejad is elected. The supreme leader is chosen by a council of clerics. And this is a combination of democracy and theocracy. It's a theocratic society. It's not a democracy in the American sense, because the big emphasis is not on a society that is free in the individual sense. The emphasis is on a society that is righteous in a religious sense. That's what's considered most important, more important than any other factor. It's more important that people leave a righteous life, a religious life, a life in accordance with those principles, than that they're prosperous or that they get ahead. There's not the Iranian dream, if you make it very simplistic, is not to have a nice big car and a house. The official Iranian dream is that people lead a righteous life. And that is reflected over and over in many aspects of life that I saw there. Now, what does this mean for America and our country? Now, the rhetoric against Iran and the vilification of Iran is just breathtaking it oversteps all bounds of any kind of objectivity. When Ahmadinejad was just the other day in New York City, the New York Daily News and the New York Post newspapers ran just vicious headlines denouncing Ahmadinejad as vile, as shit. I mean, just unbelievable language that would not be used in any other way. Now, I was asked many times about Ahmadinejad and my impression of him. Of course, I only saw him very briefly, but after the talk was over and I was talking with an Iranian about his speech that he gave, one person said to me that the joke is that Ahmadinejad gives the same speech over and over again. And in fact, the speech he gave at the UN made many of the exact same points that he made in the speech that I was attending. And if you go back and look on the internet, you'll find in other speeches. Ahmadinejad, I think, is a sincere man. He's somewhat mystical. He's very religious. He's certainly no hater. He's certainly no man who wants to destroy the United States. Now, the reason I say that isn't just my impression or whatever, but I'm going to give in some details about this. But the point he made in the speech that I heard and also in the United Nations contained an element that you would not expect of any normal statesman of a country. In both of these speeches and in many other speeches, he talked about his hope what they call the hidden imam, the Imam Mahdi, and Jesus will return to earth. He believes this very strongly. And this is a particular belief among many Shia Muslims, especially among Shia Muslims. They believe that a new era of peace and of harmony in the world will come when the hidden imam and Jesus, he keeps on stressing this thing about Jesus, will come to earth. Again, they revere Jesus. They regard him as a prophet, an important prophet, in fact. And they believe that this will usher in this new world. Now, it's very unusual, though, for a statesman, a president of a country, to keep emphasizing this point when he's speaking to the United Nations. I mean, not even the Pope talks about religion in that kind of way when he's addressing the United Nations. But this is what Ahmad Ahmadinejad. Now, Ahmadinejad is by training an engineer. He's well educated. He was mayor of Tehran. And his base of support is especially among poorer people. He lives a very modest life. By all accounts, he lives in the same little house that he had before he was president. He'll go back to living there after his term ends. He drives his own little Peugeot car. He's I think, sincerely an honest man. But the larger point is this. Is Iran, as the American media likes to say, a threat to America or a threat to other countries? This is a point that's made over and over in the American media, which tells the American public that they should be afraid of this dangerous country. Now, a few things to keep in mind. Iran has not attacked another country in, what, two centuries. It has been attacked, though, by other countries over a period of time. Everyone in Iran is very mindful of a long war, 8 years, from 1980 to 1988, against Iraq. Iraq invaded Iran in 1980 under Saddam Hussein because he thought Iran was weak because they had had the revolution, and he tried to grab some territory in the south of the country. Now, in this war, supposedly 1 million people were casualties. Iranians say 500,000 people died in this war. Now, this is a country of some 70 million people. That is, now, 500,000 is 10 times approximately the number who died in Vietnam in a country far smaller in population. Iranians are very aware, and what they're also aware of is that in this murderous war, in this act of aggression against their country, the Saddam Hussein regime was supported by the United States of America. The leader that the United States later claimed was so evil he had to be overthrown, Saddam Hussein, was a leader that America actually supported during this war. And Donald Rumsfeld, who at the time was Deputy Secretary of Defense, went to visit and shake hands and confirm America's support for Saddam Hussein. Now, America's role in that war is not a very one that very many Americans should be very proud of, no matter what your political views may be. But it's something Iranians remember, that America did everything in their power to support an aggression against their country. But their minds and their memories go back further than that. In 1953, the government of Iran was headed by a man named Mohammad Mossadegh. Mohammad Mossadegh was a nationalist. He came from a fairly wealthy family, and he wanted to nationalize the oil industry of Iran, which at that time was run by something called the Anglo-Iranian Petroleum Company. Anglo-Iranian has now changed its name. Its name nowadays is BP. ARCO stations all over California are owned by BP. It's an enormous conglomerate, and it got its start originally as the Anglo-Persian, then the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company. In 1953, Iranians were furious that the wealth of their country, that the most important asset that they had, was controlled not by Iranians, but by foreigners, and they wanted to take it over by Iranians. Well, the British didn't like that idea. They wanted to keep control of the oil. And so the British, supported by the Americans, in fact, it was the American CIA that carried it out, overthrew the government of Mossadegh, in which thousands of people were killed, by the way. The Shah of Iran, who at that time didn't have the same power, fled the country, and then the US CIA and the British Secret Service paid mobs of people to carry out this so-called uprising against the Mossadegh government, paid people in the Iranian military to organize a coup against the government to install the Shah as a dictator of the country. Now, that's also something that people in Iran remember. they remember that a dictator of their country was imposed on them by the United States of America. And that's something not many Americans either know or want to remember. But it doesn't start there either. It goes back further than that. In 1941, Iran was a neutral country. World War II was going on. Germany, Britain, the Soviet Union were all at war during that period of time. Iran was neutral. Now, Iran was on friendly terms, or tried to be on friendly terms, with everybody. It was a neutral country, including with Germany. Well, in order, though, because Britain was supporting the Soviet Union during World War II, the way to supply the Soviet Union was through Iran. And so in August 1941, British and Soviet Russian forces invaded, killed Iranians, and occupied Iran. The Soviet Russians occupied the northern part of the country, and the British occupied the south, not only to provide a supply route for supplies to the Soviet Union, but also to make sure that the oil of Iran was going to stay in British hands. Now, at that time, the leader of Iran was Shah Reza Khan Pahlavi. He was the father of the notorious Shah. He wrote a letter to Franklin Roosevelt in which he said, "Mr. Roosevelt, you have claimed over and over, you've said over and over that you support freedom and independence and self-determination of peoples. We are a neutral country. Our country is now being invaded by the British and by the Soviets. We want your help against this invasion." Well, Franklin Roosevelt in the United States basically said, "Go to hell." They said, because America, which by the way was a supposedly neutral country at the time, was actually illegally supporting the Soviet Union and Britain during the war, it said that Iran had to put up with this invasion, this humiliation, and these deaths of their own people because the larger goal of defeating Germany overrode all of that. Well, Iranians remember that. And Khomeini, who was the Ayatollah Khomeini, was a teenager at the time. He later recalled how humiliated he felt that his country should be invaded and humiliated this way with the backing, not only by the British and the Soviets, but the backing of the United States. So Iranians remember these things. They remember the role and the relationship of the United States in a way very differently than many Americans do. Now, one of the basic principles of justice, the basic principle of justice in all of human relations and throughout history is the principle that we treat others the way we want to be treated ourselves. It's in the New Testament. Jesus says, "Do to others as you would have them do unto you." This is the basic principle of justice that's been enshrined in many different cultures and many different religions over time. And it means that not only in personal relations, but also in relations between countries, that justice requires a respect for the feelings, the attitude, and the behavior of others. But in the relations and the history of the United States of America with Iran and increasingly with other countries is not characterized by the golden rule. It's characterized by an astonishing arrogance. Unbelievable. Just recently, the United States of America, the U.S. government under Barack Obama, declared that a key feature of U.S. foreign policy is, as he put it, to ensure and to fight for gay rights all over the world. All over the world. He wrote, this is what Barack Obama said, "The struggle to end discrimination against lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender persons is a global challenge and one that is central to the United States' commitment to promoting human rights." Now, I'm not saying what the view should be about homosexual rights, gay rights, and so forth, but to consider that just 50, 60 years ago, homosexuality was considered shameful and a crime in America, it's amazingly galling and arrogant for the United States to now say, "Forget what we used to do. This is the way not only we're going to do it, but the way everybody in the world is supposed to do it." The idea of a country telling other countries like this is unbelievable arrogance, and it's one of the reasons why the United States is so infuriates so many people around the world. Now, this kind of arrogance manifests itself in many, many other ways as well. And it's manifest above all in the very U.S. special relationship with Israel. When Prime Minister Netanyahu spoke last at the U.S. Congress. He received, depending on your count, 29 or 30 standing ovations. That's more standing ovations than an American president gets, and more than Netanyahu gets from his own parliament in Israel. Now, why is that? Why is the United States politicians, why are they so enthusiastically in a love feast with the Prime Minister of Israel? Is it that Americans are wiser, more insightful, more understanding of the realities of the world than any other country? Or is it, and this is what I believe, a reflection of the power and the agenda and the outlook of those who hold power in this country, and the American people do not realize the extent to which they are misled and misguided in this way? Now, the great question in the world, one of the great questions in the world today is, will Israel attack Iran? And if so, will the United States do so? The unbelievable gall. Israel is saying, says over and over, that Iran should not even have the ability to have a nuclear weapon. And if they do, we're going to attack them. Now, imagine if that principle is applied to any other country. I mean, the United States, of course, and Israel have attacked many countries over the world. On that basis, as I've said many times, if the United States held Israel to the same standards that it has held Iraq or Iran, the United States would be attacking Israel. It would be bombing Tel Aviv. It would arrest the leaders of Israel and put them on trial for war crimes. But the American media gives the impression that Netanyahu is this hard-pressed man who's just running out of patience about this exasperating country that's building, maybe, we think, nuclear weapons. You know, his own defense secretary, as I said, has said that Iran has not even made a decision whether to build nuclear weapons or not. But the American public and American politicians, American public is misled, and American politicians give this impression over and over. They talk about the danger of a nuclear Iran as if the country has nuclear weapons. This is extraordinarily dangerous. Now, the world has been very aware recently of the enormous riots and anger that has been across the Muslim and Arab countries with the United States over this film that portrays Mohammed in this very insulting way. The president of Pakistan, a country where there's been especially large riots or protest marches in this way, he made a very interesting point, one that should be emphasized. He says, in the West, and specifically in several countries, it's a crime to even contest certain questions about World War II and the Holocaust. That's a crime. And it's done so because we're told over and over that we have to be very sensitive to Jewish sensibilities and Jewish feelings about this issue. That Jews have a special feeling about the victims of the Holocaust, and anybody who is insulting that should be shut up and, in fact, in some countries, put in jail. But that same sensibility applies only to this one group of people. There is no similar law. There are not similar laws to protect the sensibilities, the religious sensibilities of Muslims, or for that matter, for Christians. And it's not just that people are angry because this film is made. What angers people is the arrogance and the hypocrisy, the double standard that's behind all of this. And I want to emphasize these points to try to understand, again, something of the mentality, something of the feeling in these countries. There is no good reason why Iran and the United States should be enemies. Look, during the whole period of the Stalinist period of the Soviet Union, when the Soviet Union was at its most oppressive and tyrannical, the United States always maintained diplomatic relations with the Soviet Union. The American presidents, Roosevelt and Truman, both met with Soviet dictator Joseph Stalin. When Mao Zedong, who most historians say is responsible for the deaths of far more people than Hitler is accused of killing, when he was in power, Richard Nixon, President of the United States, flew and shook hands with Mao Zedong. Now, if it's possible for the United States to have at least civil or normal diplomatic relations with Stalinist Russia and with Mao Zedong China, certainly it should be possible for the United States to have normal diplomatic relations with Iran. Iran not only doesn't have I believe, the desire. It doesn't even have anything like the ability to be a threat to the United States. In fact, it's odd that the countries the United States consider and gets very angry about are not countries that really are powerful. China is run by the Communist Party of China. It doesn't have a free press. It's run by the Communist Party of China. It has a much larger military than Iran does by many, many magnitude. But the United States doesn't threaten China. Why does the United States threaten Iran in this way? Or to make another comparison, India and Pakistan some years ago, despite protest and despite pleas by the United States, developed and exploded nuclear weapons. They both have nuclear arsenals. And for a very short time, the United States imposed some sanctions against India and Pakistan for doing that. Then came the war on terror, and America said, well, forget all of that. Now we're friends again. But the point is, it imposes on Iran a standard that it does not impose on these other countries. Again, what's the reason for this? It's because, as the American ambassador to Israel, Daniel Shapiro, said about a year ago, the central feature of U.S. foreign policy, he said this to a Jewish audience about a year and a half ago, the central consideration in U.S. foreign policy is the securing the interests of Israel, not only as a state, but as a specifically Jewish ethnic religious state. That's a pledge the United States makes to no other country in the world. It doesn't pledge that Ireland's going to remain a white country or a Christian country. It pledges Israel, though, that it's going to be defended not merely as a state, but as a specifically Jewish state, a pledge it makes to no other country. Now, and Shapiro said that this commitment, this outlook, runs throughout the American government, he said. And it's the central pivot, the central consideration in U.S. Middle East policy. Now, my friends, it doesn't take any super patriot or strange radical person to think that U.S. foreign policy should be based first and foremost on what's good for America and what's good for humanity. Those should be primary considerations, not what's good for Israel. Israel's problems are problems of its own making, and there's a lot of things that could be said about that. But America, for America to tie its relations to Israel, a country that from its very beginning has required always constant infusions of support from the outside, even to stay in place, is an extremely dangerous situation. Now, there are some people in America who justify the special relationship by saying, well, it doesn't really matter. It's all part of the plan of God that the earth is coming to an end. We're all going to have a huge nuclear Armageddon. And by the way, all the Jews are going to die too in this thing. But we're going to be saved shows such selfishness and so short-sightedness that people should be astonished and appalled that anybody is even allowed to express such views and given a forum in our country. But that's the situation here. Now, my visit to Iran was very eye-opening, and I went very much, and I encouraged this when I was there. Many, many more people should visit there and learn and try to understand some of these things ourselves. We should try to understand as maximum awareness, not only about the situation of Iran, but throughout the Middle East, because this war that's being threatened now by Israel is a war that will have very terrible consequences, not just for the people of Iran, but for Americans and for all of humanity, and that should be our great consideration. Thank you.